Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day and a special presentation of All of It. We'll hear excerpts from the MLK celebration, which was a collaboration between WNYC and the Apollo. I had an opportunity to host it last weekend with my colleague Jamie Floyd at the legendary Apollo Theater in Harlem. This is a proud tradition for WNYC, and this year's theme was The Strategic King, MLK's Visionary Leadership. And with that, let's go to the Apollo.
Joining Allison Stewart on the Apollo Theater stage is NPR national correspondent Hanzi Lo Wang, educator, Washington Post opinion columnist, and Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Jonathan Capehart, and civil rights leader, nonprofit executive, and president of Color of Change, Rashad Robinson.
So our goal today is to talk about modern media strategy when we talk about social justice and covering social justice. And it's interesting because you all three come from a different perspective. So Hanzi, you have to report it as a journalist. You have to investigate it. Rashad, your job is to engage someone like Hanzi and make your point, be an activist, and really provide a certain position. And Jonathan, you're job is to think deeply about it and then write thoughtfully about it and come to conclusions. So it's going to be a very interesting conversation, I think, to think about this issue. Rashad, let me start with you. How has your media strategy, you've been with Color for Change about 9-10 years now? About
a decade? Yeah.
How has the media strategy changed philosophically in the past 10 years for you? Like, think about where you were in 2011, 2012, and where you are today.
Yeah, well, when Color of Change started, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, right, black people were literally on their roofs begging for the government to do something, and they were left to die. And Katrina didn't illustrate new things, right? It showed things that we already knew: geographic segregation, generational poverty, the impacts of what we've done to our planet and so many other systems. But at the heart of Katrina, no one was nervous about disappointing black people. Government, corporations, and media. And when institutions are not nervous about disappointing your community, it doesn't matter what kind of research report you have that illustrates all the facts and figures and details. It sometimes doesn't even matter what you do in the courts if you don't have the power to implement it. Brown versus Board of Education is a perfect example about where our schools are at in terms of segregation right now. And so the question about media strategy is not simply about getting our stories out, but about getting our stories in. And what I mean by that, it's about building the type of power that changes the rules, because we can't simply rely on media to tell our stories if the game is rigged or the structures don't work in our favor. And so as much as we have to concentrate on the kind of ideas of amplification, we also have to work to shift the actual structures and context by which the ground sort of plays itself on. And so we do that every single day through strategic campaigns. Sometimes it's a campaign to get someone like Glenn Beck or Bill O'Reilly fired and try to send a message to sponsors of media that you can't have it both ways, have a relationship with our community by day and sponsor that by night. And then the other thing is like we have to then get inside those rooms and build new power to force those institutions to be nervous. So an example of how that works is for the last 20 years in this country, violent crime has sort of steadily went down. And all crime has sort of steadily went down, with blips here and there, but steadily went down. At the same time, if you ask most Americans on survey after survey what they think about violent crime, they think it's going up. And so the gap between perception and reality causes us to have all sorts of challenges with the type of public policy we get served, where people think and are making demands based off of stories that are being told that are not actually true stories. And so if we don't actually challenge who is telling those stories, build campaigns that change the rules about how that works, but also not just the news industry, but Hollywood, whose sort of warped sense of incentive structures have created the type of dehumanizing portrayals that lead people to think that we need more police in schools instead of counselors or teachers or healthcare professionals. And so I view the job of like 21st century civil rights organizing very much in the legacy of those who have come before us. But it does mean that we can't simply be excited or happy by people telling our stories. We have to recognize that as much as our information may travel on a platform like Facebook that has 2.3 billion users, more followers than Christianity, we have to be just as fierce about challenging that platform, about all the ways in which it compromised our last election, could potentially compromise our next census, and will do all sorts of type of damage to our health, safety, and the potential for justice. Media can give us an opportunity to tell the stories, but media can also bank in the status quo. And we have to be willing to do both and not settle just for visibility.
So I'm hearing you say advocacy and challenge. It's a combination of the two.
It is a combination of two, and it's about sort of the type of stories we tell. Far too often people think of inequality as unfortunate, almost like it's a car accident, it sort of just happened, rather than unjust. And when we tell stories that are not rooted in unjust, but rooted in sort of unfortunate, we get charitable solutions to structural problems. Right. False stories about charity instead of true stories about justice actually create the wrong type of motivation for us to build the type of power that actually makes things better, doesn't just keep things the same way.
Jonathan, how has the speed and the omnipresence of news and a news story challenged you as an opinion writer and a journalist, especially around social justice issues? And can you share with us a time when you saw it shifting before your eyes while you were working on something?
One, you just heard why Rashad Robinson is perhaps one of the most important voices there are in this country about social justice. You know, the speed of news today is so, as you know, Allison, it's breakneck. All of you in this audience have the same access to the amount of information that I do as a journalist. And it's coming at us, we used to call it a fire hose. That doesn't even begin to describe how much news is coming at us. You all know what's happening in the news. I view my job now in this incarnation, my job is to take a step back and help you, in however way you consume information, make sense of what's happening. I find that, and in the 10 years, I guess, that I've been on Twitter, the number one thing that I get back from readers is they're coming to me for context. And I think news consumers today, because they are just drowning in a tsunami of news, they are looking for someone to say, like, I know what the news is. Tell me why I should care. Tell me why this story, this event, this major happening going on in my community, in my nation, in the world, how does that story fit into a larger conversation? Help me understand why these things are happening so then I can make my own judgments about what I think about X, Y, or Z. In terms of a specific situation that happened, Ferguson, I was subbing the Steve Kornacki show then on MSNBC, Saturday and Sunday. Saturday night, I'm about to go to bed. I'm already late. That was an early morning wake up. It is 10 o'clock at night. And before going to bed, I look at Twitter, and there's this hashtag Ferguson that's happening. And so I click on it, and I start seeing, this is the first I had heard about the shooting of Michael Brown. And now here I am reading and getting more and more disturbed, and I'm emailing with the producers of the show saying, I know normally this isn't what y'all do, but I feel compelled. We need to say something about this. That is the beauty of the age that we are in, that people who aren't at the Washington Post, aren't running Color of Change, aren't in super big positions with one tweet, one hashtag, can put an issue or a tragedy on the national agenda in a moment's notice. But then again, once everyone gets talking about it, people then need someone who has the ability to take a step back and explain why these things are happening. And also, for all of you are news consumers. However you get your news, you are news consumers. And the number one thing, and I'll end on this, that I beg of you to do, is to not get your news from just one source. Not just one newspaper, not just one magazine, not just one website. And also, within those institutions, don't limit yourself to one particular reporter, because you've got tons of reporters reporting on things, and they're all coming at it from a different perspective, whether they're on the news side or on the opinion side, like I am, where I actually get paid to tell you what I think about things. But when you do that, especially today, when you're drowning in news, when you get your news from multiple sources, you have a better shot of understanding what's going on from a context perspective, but also from a nuts and bolts perspective.
Hanzi, I know one of the things you're concentrating on, yes. You are focusing on the census. And
yes.
A little background, you said you think Dr. King would have been a census nerd.
I think so.
Tell us why.
I think that he wanted to understand how the system worked in order to come up with strategy, in order to figure out what would be the next step in order to change society. And my reporting on the 2020 census has really helped to unearth for me this really under the radar set of policies, decision making happening often behind closed doors, buried deep within government reports. Mm-hmm. This is a constitutionally mandated headcount with 10 years worth of implications on elections, yet we don't talk about it as often as we do about elections.
Right.
It is mentioned, the census, before any mention of a president, before mention of voting. It is the sixth sentence of the Constitution. And so this is something that I think that Dr. King, I would imagine, would be aware about and would think about and would want greater public understanding in order to understand how does this system work that you might want to change.
When you think about your reporting in the census and you think about social justice, what are you looking for? What kind of stories are you going to pursue?
I'm looking for stories that really help people understand the very basics that when we're talking about the census, we're talking about money, mm-hmm. we're talking about power. That's really what we're talking about. If you think the census is not a sexy topic, not really newsworthy, I would say you probably don't understand what the census actually is and the full implications of it. And it is a very wonky topic. Very quickly, we get to talk about survey methodology and statistics, which is not my background. And so I've had to do some learning. And my job as a journalist is to take what I learn and share that with a broader audience so that people can understand how this works. It happens once every 10 years. A lot of people don't understand that, don't remember it, haven't participated in it before, and maybe have a lot of concerns and fears about participating in it. And the concern here is that there's just a lack of knowledge.
Also, people are concerned about not being counted. And I know that's part of what you're concentrating on, Rashad, going forward.
Yeah, I mean, we've launched a platform called ourcount.org, which is really focused on ensuring that the count happens. Back in 2010, there was an undercount of 2 million children, probably about 60%+ of them were children of color. What that does is it impacts all sorts of ways in which resources flow to communities to help young people at the very beginning of their lives. There's no accident here in what's happening with the census. This is a coordinated strategy by folks who have not wanted us to exist. They have the money, we have the people, and the people mobilize and organize, the people can win.
Two quick last questions. Jonathan, when you write about social justice, what columns really are landing today? Which ones, or one, really seem to ignite your readers?
Any column about race will always get big readership. One, I think because I'm writing about things that my audience wishes someone would write about, and so I'm writing about it, and it gets passed around. Because I'm an opinion writer, I don't just get to report on here's what's happening. I then get to say, and this is why this person is wrong, this person is a racist, this person is a national security threat, this person should not be in office, on and on and on and on. And if I were writing about the census, and you're right, see, I haven't written about it because, well, it's super wonky.
Yes.
And it is, to quote Sweet Brown, ain't nobody got time for that, at least for me. At least for me. However, a sexy way for me to write about it, though, would be it's not just money and resources, it's also who represents you in Congress. Because once the census is taken, then they go about redistricting, mm-hmm. and they start drawing the lines to get people into Congress. And that's why, if you don't care about the money, which I know you do, because it means money for your communities and for your roads and your streets and your schools, but it also means who is representing you in Congress. And so if you don't care about the money, at least care about who is going to Congress, to the State House, to the mayor's office, mm-hmm. and implementing policies in your name. If you have never voted before, if you have never been politically active before, I'm imploring you, Rashad is imploring you, mm-hmm. I'm leaving Hansi out because he's a news site reporter, but a journalist, but this is the time to make your voice heard, to be active in however you are able to be active. Because you're watching the news, you know what's going on. Lives are literally on the ballot in 2020.
I want to say thank you to our panelists, Hansi Lo Wong, Rashad Robinson, and Jonathan Capehart. This is the Strategic King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s visionary leadership.
This is all of it. We'll be back after a quick break. Stay with us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.